Well, this morning we are going to cover in our Psalm series with their backstories, the last Psalm of David that we will consider in this series. We still have a few more Psalms we're going to talk about that are not related to David's life, but this is the last one related to David's life, and it's a great Psalm, and it is so uncanny, unearthly, because it's talking about David's prophecy of a coming captivity. We'll say more about that in a minute, but start with this. We're all aware now of the multiverse, parallel universes, because it's in all of our daily popular conversations and movies, in the Avengers, Ant-Man, Spider-Man, Doctor Strange, Star Trek. It's always about parallel universes, the multiverse. That is a very speculative concept and theory, and most scientists don't even believe in it. But atheists are eager to embrace the multiverse concept, because then they can push back the question of origins. Where did everything come from? They can push it back farther and farther and farther until it's almost out of sight and they don't have to deal with it. But it has lots of problems. It was first proposed by a devout atheist named Hugh Everett, and he was not comforted by his own science. His biographers say that he suffered from severe depression and severe alcohol addiction basically all of his adult life. They said that he had a fundamentally bleak outlook on life as an adult. His two children thought of him as emotionally distant. There was no great relationship there. He died of heart failure at only 51 years old, especially because he was a chain smoker, a very heavy drinker, and also obese. Although he was married, he was a serial womanizer and client of prostitutes. His daughter took her own life eventually, saying that it was after her dad died, saying that she wanted to go to the same parallel universe where her dad was. His son reported that when he found his dad lying after the heart attack dead, he went to feel his pulse, his dad's pulse, and it occurred to him as he was doing that, that that's the first time he can remember touching his dad. And when his body was then discovered, he had to be buried or something, and his last wishes were that his body would just be thrown in the trash. And so, you know, he was cremated and his ashes were thrown in the trash, disposed of. It's a very sad story, but it always was going to be a sad story, really. Once a person locks in to the demoralizing idea that there is no God. And that's what we're talking about today. We're looking at two Psalms. Psalm 14 and 53 are basically the same. If you had your Bible open to both of them at the same time, line for line, they're almost exactly the same. You'll see that there are 29 words in verses 5 and 6 of Psalm 14, as opposed to 33 words in Psalm 53, verse 5. But except for those little differences, it's the same psalm twice. And so we're going to consider them, of course, together. You think, is that okay to have the same thing said twice? Like, sure. In Psalm 18, we see it was identical to what was said in 2 Samuel 22. So same thing twice in the Bible. And you can see that the last, or all five verses in Psalm 70 are identical to the last five verses in Psalm 40. So we do have some repetition in the Psalms, and that's okay. The superscriptions of Psalm 14 and 53 say that this is, you know, these are indeed Psalms of David. So to the chief musician, a Psalm of David. And Psalm 53 says, to the chief musician upon Mahalath. And we don't really know what Mahalath means. It is sometimes used for sickness. Did he mean that this is a psalm about being sick and weary? Or is this a psalm that has to do with the instruments, the lyre or the lute? These are instruments that were sometimes called mahalath, and we're not sure what David meant by this. But anyway, it is a maskil, that's a teaching psalm of David. Now, we've mentioned that these two psalms are almost the same, and it is uncanny that David foresees the captivity of his nation, which will eventually split to be two nations, Israel and Judah. So remember, David lives about 1000 B.C., the captivity for the 10 northern tribes took place in 722. So David is seeing 300 years in the future. He says, oh no, there's going to be Assyrian captivity taking the 10 northern tribes away. And he also sees the captivity of the two southern tribes, Israel and Judah, in 605. So that's 400 years away. So David is looking in these psalms. He says, oh no, 300 years for the 10 northern tribes, and 400 years from now for the 2 southern tribes, we're going to be in captivity. But the Lord is going to bring us out of captivity. So you see in the green font there, it's the same in both Psalms. When the Lord brings back the captivity of his people, Jacob shall rejoice and Israel shall be glad. So here's our question. How could David know 300 or 400 years before it happened that his nation would go into captivity? And then how could he know that the Lord would bring them back from captivity? How could he know such a thing? And the answer is, he's a prophet, and the Bible is a supernatural book. So here's what it sounds like from Psalm 14, which is just like, really, Psalm 53, but we're just going to read one. So Psalm 14, verse 1. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They've done detestable works. There is no one who does good. The Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any who understand and seek God. They have all gone aside. They have altogether become filthy. There is no one who does good. No, not one. Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon the Lord? They, the workers of iniquity, were there in great fear eventually, for God is in the generation of the righteous to help the righteous and to punish their oppressors. It says, you have shamed, you know, you who didn't believe in God, you have shamed the counsel of the poor because the Lord is his refuge. He said, well, the Lord isn't going to help you. You've shamed him for that. And then, oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion. Zion is, you know, the temple mountain, the holy place, God's address on planet Earth. Oh, that salvation would come for Israel out of Zion. When the Lord brings back the captivity of his people, Jacob shall rejoice and Israel shall be glad. So that's our text. We want to look at the foolishness of atheism today, because there are still a lot of atheists in our world and in the university system, and a lot of people who pride themselves in how intelligent they are, they still embrace atheism. And these Psalms directly address that, because they say the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. So we're going to talk about the foolishness of atheism. We're going to say something about the inability of lone humanity to be good. And we call that theologically depravity. And then we're going to say something about God's rescue from atheism and depravity. So here we are. Verse 1 of our text, Psalm 14, verse 1 says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Now this is a very high-risk thing for the Bible to say. It's a very high-risk thing for you to say, because if you tell somebody that he's a fool, if he says there is no God, he'll be mad at you. Charles Spurgeon rightly said, if you tell a man he's evil, he will look at you with an amused smile. But if you tell him he's a fool, he'll be angry at you. You say, oh, I think you're evil. And say, yeah, you know, ain't I just? You say, I think you're a fool. They'll be mad at you. And so the Bible says, actually, if you say there's no God, you're a fool. So this is not me saying it right. I'm just reading the text. All right. The fool said in his heart, there's no God. In verse 6, you shame the counsel of the poor because the Lord is his refuge. Say, oh, you're leaning on the Lord. That's not going to work. That's a loser's idea. We don't actually know how many people in ancient times would actually declare that there's no God at all. But we do know that a lot of people said that God never does anything to help or hinder human beings, so don't worry about it. We know that from the prophet Zephaniah. Zephaniah 1:12 says, I will punish the men who say in their hearts, the Lord will not do good, neither will he do evil. There's nothing God ever does about it, so it really doesn't matter. There are a lot of people throughout history, ancient and modern, who say exactly that. The Lord never really does anything. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. That is a true statement, as offensive as it might be, but the foolishness of atheism is evident. So, for example, our atheist neighbors, imagine that our cosmos just accidentally popped into existence. Everything that you see around, absolutely everything, came from absolutely nothing. See, that's foolish. That's not how universes come into existence. Our atheist neighbors imagine that high morals and mathematical logic and artistic beauty, which makes our life pleasant, right? That all these just popped into existence out of this chemical stew that we call the human brain, just popped into existence. And they say, our atheist neighbors say, that all seemingly supernatural occurrences are actually just silly illusions. all the demon possessions and answers to prayer and near-death experiences that you hear about, they're all fake and false. And of course, that is rather foolish. Our atheist neighbors steal our language when they're trying to talk about life. So, for example, in naturalistic atheism, you know what you are? You are just a leather bag of chemicals. That's what you are. You have no soul. You have no mind, as we sometimes say. You have a brain. That's all you have. And everything that you think and everything that you are just comes from your brain. This chemical construction in your leather bag body, that's all you are. Well, it's interesting then, if we are only just a leather bag filled with salt water, then why do we use language like this? Why do even atheists use language like this? Natural selection. Can a bag of salt water select anything? DNA information. Can a bag of salt water either receive or give information? Why are we talking about information in DNA? Can a bag of salt water find anything? Because the popular term from Jurassic Park is life finds a way. Can a bag of salt water find anything? Certainly, can it find life? And our atheist friends talk about good and evil. It's evil for you to perpetrate hate speech. But why is it evil? Can a bag of salt water be good or evil? How can salt water be good or evil? That doesn't make sense. And anytime an atheist uses the word ought, that doesn't make any sense. You say, well, you ought to do this, or people ought not to do that. Can a bag of salt water have anything he ought to do or ought not to do? That's impossible, right? We talk about human rights. Can a bag of salt water have rights? Can a bag of salt water have more rights than another bag of salt water? Or they all have equal rights? Do any of these bags of salt water have right to life? Does salt water have a right to life? And does salt water have the ability to perpetrate hate speech? See, if you're just an amalgamum of chemicals, then none of this language makes any sense. But atheists use our language. This is Christian language. They use our language all the time. Sarah Salviander grew up in the 1970s and 80s in an atheist home. Nice people, but atheists. And she was a very good student. By the age of 9, she knew that she wanted to be a space scientist, and she sure did. She became an astrophysicist and is to this day. And she started as an atheist, but then things started to occur to her as she studied and grew. She said, for the first 25 years of my life, I met only 3 people who identified as Christian. I was actively hostile toward Christianity. I had come to believe that Christianity made people weak and foolish. I embraced that belief that my own life was my own and that I could make of it what I wanted. But as I began to experience life as an independent adult, I started to find that I had failed to answer the big questions. What is the purpose of life? Where did we come from? Why are we here? What happens when we die? The foolishness of atheism began to bug her, and so it should, because the foolishness of atheism is evident. So, consider this. An atheist will say, there's an enormous difference between atheism and faith. And we say, atheism is faith. And they say, no, it isn't. And we say, I'm sorry, I thought you believed it. You see? They say, we value science, and absolutely everything came from absolutely nothing. We say, we value science, but in science, there's no evidence that anything can possibly come from nothing. But there is much evidence in science that material objects come from something. So if you want to have a garden, or a watch, or a book, or a baby, they all come from something. That's science. They say, we value science, and life originally came from non-life. We say, we value science. And in science, there is no evidence that life ever arises from non-life. But there's plenty of evidence in science that life comes from life. They say, we value science, and the natural universe came into existence by accident through random processes. We say, we value science, And the natural universe evidences unearthly precision and design and not randomness. They say, faith is believing in something you know isn't true, like Santa Claus or the Fountain of Youth. We say, faith is believing in something you know is true, even if you sometimes wish it weren't. They say, there are no moral absolutes. Morals are not from God. They come from evolved consensus. We say, is that statement absolutely true? That there are no absolutes? And we further say, and if the consensus of our culture says that Jews must be eradicated or Africans must be enslaved, is that now moral? They say, oppression or hate speech or rape or racism is surely evil. We say, if the human brain is merely a blend of various chemicals, as you say it is, how could it be evil? For example, how could it be evil for a cup of salt water to rust away a tin cup? Is it evil for the salt water to do that? And therefore, since chemicals are incapable of being good or evil, why do you say my chemical brain is somehow evil for oppression, rape, racism, or speaking hate language? They say oppression or hate speech or rape or racism is surely evil. We say if humans are only a few stages higher in the evolutionary chain than a wild dog, as you say we are, why is it not evil for a wild dog to bite a human, but it is evil for a human to kick a dog? They say, you don't believe in 5,000 other gods from religions around the world, and I'm like you in that way. I just believe in one less God than you. We say, actually, we do believe in 5,000 other demon gods around the world and more than that. And we believe in supernatural events, both good and evil. Part two of that is, they say, you don't believe in 5,000 other gods from religions around the world, and I'm like you when it comes to that, but I just believe in one less God than you. We say, well, that would be like a detective concluding that since he believes the other 8 billion people on planet Earth did not commit murder, he may as well conclude that one less person, that last person, also did not commit murder. That's not how this works. They say, you're making a truth claim about the existence of God, and since you're making the claim, the burden of the proof is on you to back up your claim. We say, every higher thought of every human mind, whether it is there is a God or there is no God, or maybe there is or maybe there isn't a God, every higher thought is a truth claim. And no thought faces more burden of proof than the other thought. They say faith in God is a blind leap in the dark. We say faith in God is the next logical step. When Sarah Salviander was dealing with all of this as an astrophysicist, she said, I joined campus clubs, started to make friends, and for the first time in my life, I was meeting Christians. They were joyous and content. And they were smart, too. Their personal example began to have an influence on me, and I found myself growing less hostile to Christianity. In the summer after my sophomore year, I joined a group in the Center for Astrophysics and Space Sciences. I started to sense an underlying order to the universe without knowing it. I was awakening to what Psalm 19 tells us so clearly. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of his hands. One day, as I was walking across that beautiful La Jolla campus, I stopped in my tracks when it hit me. I believed in God. I was so happy. It was like a weight had been lifted from my heart. Intellectually, I knew the Bible to be true. And as a person of intellect, I had to accept it as truth, even if I didn't feel it. That's what faith is. And C.S. Lewis said, it is accepting something you know to be true in spite of your emotions. So I converted. I accepted Jesus Christ as my personal Savior. So the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And that's the way God describes foolishness. Next, we're going to see here in our text, in our two texts side by side, the inability of lone humanity to be good. We call that depravity sometimes. In Psalm 14:1, notice the negative view of humankind that the Bible has. So Psalm 14:1, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done detestable works. There's no one who does good. The Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any who understand and seek God. And they have all gone aside. They have altogether become filthy. There is no one who does good. No, not one. When you're reading over there in Romans chapter 3, Romans 3, 10 through 12, just is basically quoting, loosely quoting, Psalm 14, 1 through 3, or Psalm 53, 1 through 3, whichever text you're in. And so we find the same idea in both Testaments, and in both cases, you see in the yellow font, there is no one who does good. Again, at the bottom, there is no one who does good. In Romans 3, 10, there is no one who does good. No, not even one. Nobody is good. And that is really important. It's what we call depravity. Left to ourselves, we would never, all of us, each of us, would never stop remaking Adam's choice in the garden. That's just what we do. It's who we are. It's the kind of people we are. That's how it is. Left to ourselves, we would just keep repeating Adam's choice over and over and over again all the days of our lives. But God has not left us to ourselves. No one is left to himself. We have the grace of God that permeates our world. Depravity does not say that every person does as many things wrong as he possibly can every minute of every day. But it does say that every part of every person's being and personality, his intelligence, what he thinks about, his emotions, what he feels, his choices that he makes, and even his physical body, every part of the human being has been corrupted, tainted, poisoned by sin. And so we are all aware of this reality that every baby, us too, every baby starts life in this world as an incontinent, illiterate savage who has to be aggressively coached to use the toilet, to read, and to respect other people. That's what David is saying. There's no one good. We have to constantly fight against our instincts and our natural propensities. Because of God's grace, all humans still have what we are now calling a moral compass, a conscience. Everybody has a conscience. The problem is, because of the fall of humanity, that moral compass is profoundly broken. And that's why, whether you're talking about small children, bullies on playgrounds, or full-grown adults, tyrants in palaces, they are all coming from the same point of view. And what is that point of view? It is, objective morality does not exist. You can't say I'm right. You can't say I'm wrong. Don't try. You do you, I'll do me. Every bully, every tyrant firmly believes that. Follow your heart. The bully and the tyrant follow their hearts. Look inside yourself for the answer. The bullies and the tyrants look inside themselves for the answers. To your own self be true. The bullies and the tyrants say, yes, this makes sense to me. I'm true to myself. Maybe 2 + 2 = 4 for you, but it equals 3 for me. So I know you don't like my morality, but I like my morality. And so the bullies and the tyrants exist in the playgrounds and in the palaces. So you see, we have a problem. There's nobody who does good. Left to himself, a person will be evil. Now, God has not left us to ourselves, but you still see the moral compass is profoundly broken. Remember what Sarah Salviander said. I joined campus clubs, started to make friends. For the first time in my life, I was meeting Christians. They were joyous and content, and they were smart too. See, this is what the Lord is doing in the hearts of people who will listen to him. And so it is, you know, incumbent upon all of us to be teachable. So then we come to God's rescue. God's rescue from atheism and depravity. And it's a great rescue. Psalm 14, verse 7. Oh, that the salvation of Israel would come out of Zion. When the Lord brings back the captivity of his people, Jacob shall rejoice and Israel shall be glad. So David foresaw something terrible on the horizon, right? 300 or 400 years in the future, depending if we're talking about Israel or Judah. 300 or 400 years into the future. And he knew that the only solution to this catastrophe was God's intervention. If God would hear from Zion, which is, you know, like where God's mailbox was on planet Earth in Jerusalem next to the temple, if God would hear from Zion and send help, then we could be released from our captivity and come back to our land where we really belong in the first place. And that's so important. We are like this. We will find no rescue from the things that are scaring us right now. You know, whatever comes to your mind when I say that. What are you anxious about right now? What kind of rattles you right now? You are not going to find any comfort from that if you are relying on your own wits and grit and a long and healthy life. That's not going to work out for you. Do you know why? Because you're really not very witty. You're not that smart. And you really don't have that much grit. You could really wither and wilt if something happens. And you really aren't going to live that long. Who are you? How long do you think you're going to live? You're going to have real troubles in your life really, really soon. And you are going to find no comfort in the thought of overcoming these things that scare you by your own wits and grit and long and healthy life. There's no comfort in that. You know what there is comfort in? That the Lord is going to send His own help to you. And He's going to relieve you from the captivities that are all around you in this world. That's your real help. Once again, Sarah Salviander says, a couple years ago, she said this in 2015, so we're like in 2013. A couple years ago, I had to face my cancer diagnosis and an unpleasant course of treatment. Not long after, my husband fell ill with meningitis and encephalitis. We didn't know if he'd be paralyzed or worse. It took him about a month, but thankfully he did recover. At that time, we were expecting our first child, a baby girl. We found out she had trisomy 18. Our daughter, Eleanor, was stillborn soon after. But after all these trials, in 1 year, my husband and I were not only closer to each other, but also felt closer to God. Isn't that something? When you cannot survive by your wits and your grit and your long and healthy life, when you can't handle your problems that way, God helps you. He rescues you emotionally and mentally, and eventually He'll even rescue you physically, and that's what we really need. So here's our conclusion from these two beautiful psalms that are basically the same. Practical atheism. Like maybe you believe that there is a God, but you think, oh, He's not really going to help me. He's not really going to be involved in my life. That's, you know, you'd say, I'm not an atheist. But you're a practical atheist because you really don't think the Lord's going to do anything for you. Practical atheism. Don't make the fool's mistake of imagining that there is no God or that God's not really going to bother with you and intervene in your life. Never do that. The fool thinks that, and you don't want to make the fool's mistake. When it comes to depravity, we have to humble ourselves and realize that we don't naturally understand. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks after God. We do not naturally understand, and we are not naturally good. What we really need is to invite the Lord to intervene in our minds so that we will understand, like, do, Lord, intervene. Give me input so I do understand. And do intervene in my life, you know, to make me a better person, to make it possible for me, as the Lord's Prayer says it, to be delivered from temptation. You know, do, I invite you. I, far from being an atheist, I want you to intervene in my life. I invite every bit of that as much as I can possibly have. And when it comes to our rescue, our hope cannot be in our wits and grit and a long and healthy life. That is a dead end. The only thing that will give you comfort in this world is knowing that the Lord Himself will send from Zion, from His address, His own help, and He's going to rescue you spiritually, emotionally, and someday even physically. And that's what's going to give you help when all these captivities of this world drag you down.